You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 106, Book of Obadiah, Part 1. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Good. How are you doing this week, Trey?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm excited to get back into the books of the Bible here.
Yeah, back into the Old Testament, you know, back into everyone's favorite book, the book of Obadiah.
And this is one book that I'm clueless. I do not remember anything, so I'm excited to hear it fresh.
Yeah, well, odds are good that you've never heard a sermon or anything on it. So
never. Yeah.
It's very neglected.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know what, with only, you know, 20 some verses, I mean, 21 verses, what can you expect? I think though, you know, I think it's fair to say that this will be yet another example, again, of many that we've had on the podcast of why it's important to have the Old Testament or Old Testament theology floating around in your head in order to understand New Testament theology. And that might sound crazy, like, you know, well, I've never heard anybody going through the New Testament anywhere talk about Obadiah. Well, yeah, that's the problem. Okay, that's the whole point. It actually does contribute to a number of things, theological points in the New Testament. So I think we'll get an illustration of that again. And of course, the corollary to that is kind of, you know, why it's a travesty to not hear the Old Testament preached. And boy, we could do probably a whole episode on why that is, you know, why it's neglected, willful neglect, laziness, just lack of training, who knows. But I mean, I've run into people who have sat under ministries that are very public, very high profile, where they've just been told, we're not going to bother with the Old Testament, you know, because we're Christians. And it's really a shame. And I think going into this subject, even a book as quote unquote insignificant as Obadiah will sort of reveal why that's a mistake. So we're going to do this in two parts. What I want to do in this part, the first one is essentially sort of overview the book and get into some of the content, some of the theological touch points. Again, things that will, once we get into them, will sound familiar because of things in the New Testament. But I want to save most of that for part two, but we will get into some of it here. So as far as an overview, the book of Obadiah is about Edom. Okay, it's a judgment oracle against Edom. And so we need to start with, well, why is Edom important? Why should we even care about Edom in biblical thinking? Well, because it does have a theological role. So the entire book of Obadiah, all 21 verses, is broadly speaking about the relationship between Israel and Edom. And Edom, both in Obadiah and in other prophetic books, sort of transcends just being a place, and it becomes kind of paradigmatic or a symbolic representative of the hostile nations that surround Israel, especially Babylon. And we know Babylon is important for lots of things in biblical theological thinking. So Edom is going to connect into some of those things, and hence the book of Obadiah is going to play a role in that. So as far as Edom itself, what is it? Well, it's a place name. I think most listeners are going to know that. Harper's Bible Dictionary defines it this way. The name Edom itself is derived from the Semitic root meaning red or ruddy, and given to the area situated south of the Dead Sea on both sides of the Wadi Araba because of the reddish color of the sandstone of that district, unquote. So it gives you a little bit of a geographical orientation south of the Dead Sea. The land of Edom is also known as Seir, S-E-I-R, in the Old Testament. And Edom was the place where the descendants of Esau, of course, who is the brother of Jacob, who is Israel, it's where they settled. So Edom is the older twin, Esau, Edom, the Edomites. And Esau is the older twin of Jacob and Israel. You know, we know the story about, you know, Isaac, Rebekah, Jacob, Esau, all that sort of stuff. Well, Esau's descendants get associated with Edom because that's where his descendants eventually settle. The point isn't, by mentioning all that, that Edomites were all descendants of Esau. They weren't. When Esau and his descendants eventually settled there were already people there, so not not every resident of Edom was, you know, from the line of Esau. But again, this is what the area is known for. And you know, there's this antipathy all the way back into the Jacob and Esau story. There's this they don't have the best of relationships. And that is going to, you know, eventually sort of play out. But in Genesis, as opposed to the prophets, the portrait of Esau and Edom is a little bit more positive in Genesis than it is in the prophets. By the time we get to the prophetic period, the relationship has really soured. People will remember in Genesis that Jacob and Esau sort of patched things up, maybe took it from a hostile relationship to a bit of an uneasy one. But at least, you know, not combative. That's going to get worse because of historical circumstances in the Old Testament. So as far as, again, how the place is portrayed or how Edomites are portrayed, again, in the prophetic books, as I mentioned, it's going to get a little bit worse. Edom's land is, again, sort of symbolic of the adversarial nations for a simple reason, because Edom, like all the other nations, is not Canaan. Remember, Canaan is the promised land. Canaan is the land where Israel is supposed to dwell. It's the land God gives to Israel. It's the land God gives to the chosen seed of Abraham. Of course, and the Edomites are on the periphery of that. They're not included, you know, in the line of Jacob. It's a different line. It's related, but it's not the same. And so Edom becomes, again, viewed the same way as foreign nations would. You aren't Canaan. Okay, you're not in the covenantal fold, you know, that idea. That's just the way the prophets, again, start to talk about the place and the people. In the biblical story, Edom ultimately, and unfortunately, assists Babylon in the destruction of Judah. Of course, Judah is the Davidic kingdom. Remember your history of Israel. After Solomon, the kingdom splits into north and south. Northern kingdom, called Israel or Ephraim, sometimes called Samaria in the prophets, have 10 tribes, and the two remaining tribes are in the south. The biggest one of the two is Judah, and so the southern kingdom is referred to as Judah. But that's where David's line is living, that's where Jerusalem is, that's where the temple is, so on and so forth. So Edom, again, is not included, you know, in the southern kingdom. Edom is peripheral to that. And eventually, again, this relationship deteriorates from the days of Jacob and Esau, and Edom winds up helping Babylon in some way, and the book of Obadiah actually goes into some of that, helps Babylon to destroy Judah, you know, and to essentially cut off, in a political sense, the line of David. So Obadiah, along with other passages in other prophetic books, foretells Edom's own doom and destruction because, you know, of what they've done. It's basically a mirror repayment. What I mean by that is some of the language in Obadiah and elsewhere in the prophets describe Edom's doom and destruction in the same way as Israel's land had been destroyed prior to that, you know, in the days of Nebuchadnezzar. So after we get the fall of the southern kingdom and Edom, you know, helps Babylon out, you know, the prophets are going to, you know, come back and say, well, you're going to get yours too. And it's going to happen just pretty much in the same way. You know, some of these same awful things that happened to the people of Jerusalem are going to happen to you. So it's this mirror repayment idea for Edom's treachery against Israel. Now, the way it's cast though, and this is going to take us into, your ears are already going to perk up here. As far as New Testament connections with something we just talked about recently. The destruction, the judgment on Edom, is cast as occurring in conjunction with Israel's return from exile to repossess the land. So there's this whole, again, idea of Israel coming back. You know, when we talked in recent episodes about eschatology, you know, all Israel will be saved and all that stuff, you know, what that language means. But with the idea of Israel coming out of exile for real, okay, not just, you know, the two tribes, but all the tribes coming out of Israel and then taking possession of not only their land, but all of the nations. Well, the way Obadiah, again, talks about Edom in that way, and other prophets as well, there's this symbiotic relationship between when Edom gets judged, this is also going to be part of it. This is, you know, in conjunction with the return from exile, the deliverance from exile, and again, Yahweh asserting his authority over all the nations. And we know that, of course, is quite eschatological. So Edom is therefore a place or an item of interest in both Old Testament, and when we start thinking about what's going to happen to Edom, again, cast in books like Obadiah, then that's going to take us, again, into this thinking about what does it mean for Israel to be out of exile? What does it mean for Israel to be a kingdom again? What does it mean, you know, for Edom to be dealt with? And since there's sort of this, again, symbolic reference to Babylon or symbolic reference to all the nations, how does that play into sort of an already but not yet eschatology? Obadiah actually has something to contribute to the already but not yet eschatology that we've talked about so many times on the podcast. Now, back in Genesis, you don't see a whole lot of this. It's a little more positive or at least neutral. Yeah, Edom's not Canaan, but you know, Edom's still a nice place. I mean, Esau isn't going to be where, you know, the Israelites are, but it's not this awful place. It's still a good land. He'll still make a good living there. They'll still be happy. But when you get to the prophets, Edom is just a place of doom. And it's because of the history that accrues from the time of Jacob all the way up into the monarchy when the classical prophets are writing. Again, there's just a lot of baggage that comes with it. Now, in the Old Testament, more broadly speaking, there are essentially four sort of main prophetic oracles in the Old Testament that concern Edom. We have Obadiah, obviously. Ezekiel 35 and 36 is one of these. The language, again, is fairly neutral. It sounds a lot like the Genesis kind of relationship. Again, at least neutral, if not somewhat positive, of a portrayal. Edom in Ezekiel 35 and 36 sort of represents the neighboring nations around Israel that were said to originate out of Abraham's lineage, out of his family. Again, so it's just sort of historical and kind of neutral. But when you get into the other prophets, the other, you know, major oracles, Isaiah 34, Jeremiah 49, 7 through 22. They link Edom with Babylon, and it's not good news, and they're very negative. So at issue, you know, with all of this is who occupies the promised land, what's going on as far as, again, God paying Edom back for what they had done. How is this going to work? Because God isn't going to forget his promises. You know, is Edom going to get theirs? Is Israel going to come back? How does that affect the relationship? These are all sorts of things, again, that are talked about and portrayed in the book of Obadiah. The possession of the promised land is an issue in all of the oracle references in the prophets. In Genesis, Jacob, of course, was promised the land of Canaan. And of course, we know the story when he, you know, Jacob goes off and does his own thing in Haran with Laban. And when he decides to come back, when he gets prompted by God through circumstances to come back, you know, on his way back, he hears that Esau is coming out to meet him with lots of men, and he gets scared. Maybe intercepting would be a better way to put it. At least that's how Jacob reads it. So Jacob prays and reminds, you know, Yahweh of his promise. That's in Genesis 32. You know, he said, hey, I thought I was going to become a great nation here. So what's up with Esau coming with all these men? And, you know, again, we know the outcome of the story. Jacob is safe. You know, Esau and his men don't attack them. Again, there's at least a decent, maybe a little bit of an uneasy relationship there, but not overt hostility. Much later historically, again, in the book of Ezekiel, book Jeremiah, some of these other books, Israel's land is in danger of being taken. That's the language in Ezekiel 35, 10 through 12, taken by Mount Seir. So when you read things like that, it's like, uh-oh, you know, what's going on? And now all of a sudden the Edomites want to do something harsh, you know, take the land or invade it or something like that. You'll see in those instances, Yahweh will reiterate the promise through Ezekiel, through Jeremiah, through Obadiah, that Israel will possess this land. It's not going to be somebody else. It's going to be Israel. Now, in terms of the specific incidents, again, that prompt some of the hostility, Edom, if you go into the book of Numbers, Edom refused to allow Israel passage. Remember in the wilderness wanderings, Numbers 20, verses 14 through 21, Edom, the Edomites, these are descendants of Esau. Again, Esau was the brother of Jacob, Israel, but the Edomites refused to allow Israel passage through its territory, through their territory, during that period of wilderness wanderings. So that isn't good. David later conquers Edom in 2 Samuel 8, 13 and 14. So there's actually a violent conquest of the territory. Edom eventually revolts against the line of David. They revolt against Judah in about 850 BC. So this is after David's time in 2 Kings 8, 20 through 22. So during the monarchy, during the days of David and Solomon, there was apparently a policy among the kings of David's line to maintain as much control as possible over Edomite territory. If you were an Edomite, you're going to resent that. And so these historical circumstances create an antipathy between the two groups, between the two people. So it's no surprise that, Edom didn't regret Jerusalem's demise at the hand of Babylon and even contributes to it, even helps Babylon. Again, there's no love lost between them by that time. So Obadiah, again, is about this. It very clearly suggests that Edom helped out the Babylonians against their own brethren. And again, Jeremiah 49, Ezekiel 25, in this case, 12 through 14, Amos, first chapter of Amos, verses 11 and 12, Malachi 1, verses 2 through 5, all of them rebuke Edom for its treatment of Israel. So there's a clear indication, again, that they played a role in the decimation of Judah, the destruction of the temple, the cutting off, again, politically of David's line, all this sort of stuff. And Obadiah, again, is about the fact that God knows that and he isn't going to forget it. And Edom will get what it deserves. Now, that's the backdrop. What I want to do in the rest of the time that remains is talk about some of what's actually in the book of Obadiah. There are some really interesting phrases, some interesting vocabulary that will take your mind to certain other passages and that will show you really how negative, how evil Obadiah really gets when it comes to describing the Edomites. Now, again, some of this I'm gonna save for part two. We're gonna read through the whole book. It's only 21 verses, and I'll tell you what things we're gonna pick up in part two for the next episode. But there are some other things to camp on here that are really I think quite interesting when it comes to why should I be interested in the book and what could I possibly get out of this thing. So let's go to the beginning of Obadiah, and it says, this is the ESV, by the way, I'm reading from ESV, it says, "The vision of Obadiah, thus says the Lord God concerning Edom. We have heard a report from the Lord, and a messenger has been sent among the nations, saying, rise up, let us rise against her for battle." Now, messenger here is not the word malach, so it's not like it's not a term that you can sort of read a double reference into it, like an angelic messenger or something to do with the divine counsel, at least yet in the book. So it's a different set of vocabulary that is not elsewhere associated with divine counsel references. So we can sort of set that aside. But we have, the messenger says, rise up, let us rise against her for battle. Behold, verse 2, I will make you small among the nations. You shall be utterly despised. So again, this is God speaking to Edom, so this is not good news. Verse 3, the pride of your heart. Now, listen to the wording here. We're going to spend a little bit of time here. Listen to the next two verses. The pride of your heart has deceived you, you who live in the clefts of the rock, in your lofty dwelling, who say in your heart, who will bring me down to the ground? Though you soar aloft like the eagle, though your nest is set among the stars, from there I will bring you down, declares the Lord. Now that's Obadiah 3 and 4. And just a few things to notice here. Now, if you're a paper person, I'm sorry, you're not going to get this really anywhere. But if you're using, either something like Logos Bible software, or you're using, Blue Letter Bible, something online that can penetrate the English text, and trust me, I recommend that. Because there's a lot to see here that you wouldn't normally see just reading it off paper. Here are a few things. In verse 3, the pride of your heart has deceived you. you who live in the clefts of the rock. Now, Edom, of course, was you know, mountainous, and it had cliffs and crags. And so it's a reference to the people living in the hill country there, again, in the heights. But it the phrase here is, in your lofty dwelling. Now, the word there for lofty is kind of interesting. If you've read Unseen Realm, again, this is sort of almost a point of trivia. I don't expect people to just sort of pluck this out of their head. But if you've read my content for you know, a while, this term will trigger something in your head. The Hebrew term here is marom, which is elsewhere translated the heights. And that is an interesting term, because heights is used in, you know, the Bible, in the Hebrew Bible, for not just physical heights, but like the heights of Zaphon, okay, the cosmic, theological, supernatural heights. In other words, the place where God lives, the place where the council is, and all that sort of stuff. So are you saying, well, Mike, do the Edomites have anything to do with the divine council? Again, not per se. Just listen to the vocabulary. Edom is viewed as wicked and rebellious. And this is the first term, this is the start in verses 3 and 4, of using vocabulary to label Edom. Vocabulary that is associated with council rebellion elsewhere. So the pride of your heart, I mean, just think about the pride of your heart. Who gets judged in the council for pride? Okay, just start thinking about it. The pride of your heart has deceived you. You who live in the clefts of the rock, in the heights of your dwelling, in your lofty dwelling, who say in your heart, who will bring me down to the ground? Where does the phrase in your heart? Who said something in their heart about, again, rebellion in the divine council? Where does this come from? And it's the same, you know, phrasing. It comes from Isaiah 14. And this is Hillel ben Shakar, the shining one, the son of the dawn, the Lucifer figure. Isaiah 14, verse 13. You said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. To the heavens, really? To the heavens, the heights, really? I will ascend above the stars of God. Well, look in verse 4 in Obadiah. Though you soar aloft like the eagle, though your nest is set among the stars. It's the same term, kokavim. What about being brought down to the ground? Okay, in Isaiah 14:12, that is where Hillel ben Shakar, day star, son of the dawn, you are cut down to the ground, to the Eretz. It's the same word here in Obadiah. Who will bring me down to Eretz, to either the ground or to Sheol, to the underworld? You know, who's going to kill us off? Who's going to beat us? Again, but look at the vocabulary. You've got the heights, you've got Eretz, the ground or the underworld, you've got the stars. Therefore, I will bring you down, or bring you down. Again, this is the same vocabulary in Isaiah 14:12 about God cutting the day star down to the ground. What's happening here is Obadiah is taking something from Isaiah, or, you know, again, it's hard to know which literary direction this kind of works. But if you're going to say Isaiah is an 8th century prophet, then Isaiah 14, you know, even if you think it's late, you know, the whole Deutero-Isaiah thing, let's just go with Deutero-Isaiah. 1 to 39 is typically associated with Isaiah in the 8th century. It's before Obadiah. If Obadiah is about, you know, the rebellion, okay, the devastation with Babylon, that's post Isaiah. So chances are really good that Obadiah is taking this language of this sort of arch divine rebel, this arch criminal, and he's using vocabulary to label Edom with it. And what's really cool, what's really interesting, is if you recall Isaiah 14, who is Isaiah 14 directed at? Now, again, if you've read Unseen Realm, and if you've read anything else about, you know, Isaiah 14, you know that Isaiah 14 is not about the Lucifer figure. It's not about Genesis 3. It's not about these passages. But Genesis 3, Isaiah 14, Ezekiel 28, all draw on the backstory to all of them is a divine rebellion in the council. You have a divine rebel. And that story is used to castigate in Ezekiel 28. It's the prince of Tyre. Who is the target in Isaiah 14? It's the king of Babylon. Okay, and Babylon is associated with Edom in the book of Obadiah, because the Edomites helped the Babylonians to destroy Judah. And so Obadiah takes this language used of, again, supernatural wicked forces that were used, again, to describe Babylon's arrogance, Babylon's pride, and conceptually linked them anyway with, again, supernatural divine darkness that rebelled against the divine council, where Hillel ben Shikar wanted to ascend above the stars of God. For Isaiah 14:13, you said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven above the stars of God. I will set my throne on high. I will sit on the mount of assembly in the far reaches of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. Isaiah 14:14, I will make myself like the Most High. Okay, this language is used in Obadiah to paint Edom with the same brush. Again, it just gives you an idea of the not only the contempt that Obadiah, again, would have brought to it. I mean, because Edom is just, they're just awful. To have done this to Jerusalem is just awful. But it creates this sort of, again, bad guy, theological bad guy linkage between the Edomites and the Babylonians, and of course, the king of Babylon, and Isaiah 14, again, with the original divine rebel. Again, they're just getting portrayed the same way. This is how serious it is in the mind of Obadiah. And also, since this is, you know, God's speech through Obadiah, God is creating these linkages as well. And basically saying, if you don't think you're going to get judged, think again. Okay, I've had to deal with much, you know, bigger problems than you bunch of Edomites down there. Okay, I have dealt with rebellion on a supernatural level, on a cosmic level, in my own council. So don't think that you're getting away with anything, because you're not. Okay, it's just really interesting language. Now let's just go back to Obadiah and keep reading verse 5. If thieves came to you, again, God speaking to Edom, if thieves came to you, if plunderers came by night, how you have been destroyed? Would they not steal only enough for themselves? Again, it's a rhetorical question. Of course, they're not just going to steal what they need. They're going to loot you. You're not going to have anything left. And then the next line is, if grape gatherers came to you, would they not leave gleanings? Again, it's a rhetorical question, demanding a no answer. No, they're not going to leave anything for you. You're going to get pillaged, is the point. And then in verse 6, how Esau has been pillaged, his treasures sought out. All your allies have driven you to your border. Those at peace with you have deceived you. They have prevailed against you. Those who eat your bread have set a trap beneath you. You have no understanding. You're going to sit there and wonder, what in the world happened to us? People we thought were our friends, oh, I guess they weren't. The people we helped, you know, we fed them. They turned on them. All of these bad things, because this is what happened to Jerusalem. Again, it's this reversal idea. Verse 8, will I not on that day, declares the Lord, destroy the wise men out of Edom and understanding out of Mount Esau? And your mighty men shall be dismayed, O Timon, so that every man from Mount Esau will be cut off by slaughter. Now, again, just a word on a little bit of the language here. We have a reference here to mighty men, your mighty men. Again, this is Gibor, it's plural, Giborim, Gibore here in construct. Sorry for the Hebrew grammar lapse there, but this, we're not talking about giants here, because the very next line says, so that every man from Mount Esau will be cut off by slaughter. I'm hoping that you out there in the audience, again, realize on one level, you know, this has nothing to do with giants, Giborim, even though Giborim is used in Genesis 6:4 and all that stuff. Do you realize that Gibor is a term that is used broadly and neutrally in the Old Testament? David is called a Gibor. Right? He wasn't a giant. He wasn't like the spawn of the Nephilim or anything. Okay, it just means a warrior, a valiant warrior. Now, theologically though, okay, when people see this term in the text, it does, it will invariably raise the specter of, I guess I could put it this way, is there a connection back to the evil of Genesis 6:1 through 4? And again, if you've read Unseen Realm, you know that the connection between Genesis 6 and the whole episode, Sons of God, Nephilim, that has deep, deep Mesopotamian roots, and specifically going back to Babylon. So we do have Gibborim here, and it could be an oblique reference to, hey, maybe the gods that you think are going to help you, or you're going to get supernatural assistance or whatever. You could read it that way and say they're not going to be any good either. I personally don't think that's what's going on here, but I do think the vocabulary, again, would suggest to Edomites, just like it did with Hillel ben Shakar, that language drawn from Isaiah 14. The point is that, look, God has dealt with bigger fish than you, and you are not going to escape. I mean, you are light work compared to what God has had to deal with before. I think, again, the vocabulary connections would be better thought of in those terms, that again, Edom is being portrayed with this sort of language to make sure that readers know how wicked God views them, because God is painting them with the brush of the divine supernatural rebel of the council. And now we get, again, this Gibor reference, you know, again, part of the divine council worldview kind of thinking, God's supernatural enemies. Okay, the language of his supernatural enemies is being used to portray this earthly enemy of God's people. And when the writer does that, when biblical writers do this, they're trying to communicate just how bad, just how negatively God views whoever the object is, whoever the target is. Verse 10. So why is this going to happen? Okay, verse 10. Because of the violence done to your brother Jacob, shame shall cover you. You shall be cut off forever. Now that's kind of an interesting reference, that, you know, this whole cutting off forever, because of what we're going to talk about next week. Edom again has this eschatological link to the nations, to the reconquest of the nations. Catch my language here now. To the reversing of Babel, the reversing of Babylon. And here we go with Babylon again. So this whole cutting off together, well, what does that mean? If it's going to be reversed, you know, are there going to be any of them that could be, you know, saved, or what's going on? Because the nations, they, you know, lots of people among the nations believed in the Messiah. Okay, we'll get to that. We'll get to that in next week. But again, start thinking about the vocabulary. Verse 11, Obadiah starts into kind of a grocery list of offenses, you know, what Edom did. You can read what's coming here and know, you know, get at least a glimpse of how they helped Babylon, how they hurt their brother Jacob, Israel. Verse 11, on the day that you stood aloof, on the day that strangers carried off his, Jacob's, wealth, and foreigners entered his gates and cast lots for Jerusalem, you were like one of them. But do not gloat over the day of your brother in the day of his misfortune. Do not rejoice over the people of Judah in the day of their ruin. Do not boast in the day of distress. Do not enter the gate of my people in the day of their calamity. Do not gloat over his disaster in the day of his calamity. Do not loot his wealth in the day of his calamity. Do not stand at the crossroads to cut off his fugitives. Do not hand over his survivors in the day of distress. I mean, this is essentially a grocery list of what they did. You know, what they did to their own people, essentially their own brother. I mean, again, they're not from the line of Jacob, but they are from the line of Isaac. Okay, so, you know, this is why it's so heinous. It's so bad. It's one family member rebelling against, you know, doing the other one dirty. And if you think again about the divine council rebellion stuff, this is what you have on a cosmic level. Again, so the language again just helps bring out the severity of what they're doing, again, to compare it to, you know, supernatural rebellions. Verse 15, for the day of the Lord is near upon all the nations. As you have done, it shall be done to you. Your deeds shall return on your own head. For as you have drunk on my holy mountain, so all the nations shall drink continually. They shall drink and swallow, and shall be as though they had never been. Now, in this section, this drinking language, I want to read a bit of an excerpt from the Anchor Yale commentary on Obadiah by, I think his first name is Paul Raabe. I think that's how you say his last name, R-A-A-B-E. He writes this, in contrast to verse 15b, the second half of verse 15, which created a correspondence between Edom's sin and its punishment, quote, just as you have done, it will be done to you, unquote. Verse 16 correlates the punishment experienced by two different groups, quote, for just as you, plural, so it's the group, have drunk on my holy mountain, so all the nations will drink, unquote. The comparison begins by referring to the experience of Judah and Jerusalem, you, plural, whereas in verses 11 through 14, Obadiah portrayed the fall of Judah and Jerusalem from a human point of view when strangers and foreigners attacked, okay, or again, Edom, you know, filling in the blank here, reading between the lines, they helped. Now he interprets the same event as Zion's experience of Yahweh's wrath. He presupposes the hearers or the readers' familiarity with the cup of wrath metaphor found elsewhere. Given the metaphor's prominence in Jeremiah, who greatly influenced Obadiah, again, there's a connection, very explicit connection in Jeremiah 49, it comes as no surprise to see its presence in Obadiah. In light of the many parallels between Jeremiah's Edom oracle and Obadiah's Edom oracle, it is especially significant that the former uses the metaphor. Note that Jeremiah locates Jerusalem's cup drinking in the future, while Obadiah places it in the past, a sure sign that Jeremiah's Edom oracle predates and Obadiah postdates the 586 BC crisis. In other words, that's when Jerusalem was destroyed. And Jeremiah 49:12, he quotes the passage that says this, for thus spoke Yahweh, look, those Jerusalemites, whose right it was not to drink the cup will certainly drink, and are you, Edom, one to be exempt? No, you will not be exempt, for you will certainly drink. It's Isaiah 49, or Jeremiah 49:12. The point here is that this language is like, look, Jerusalem and Judah had a very bitter cup to drink from. In other words, they were destroyed. It was horrific, and again, it's the cup of wrath metaphor. And so this little section of Obadiah is saying, guess who's drinking next? You're going to drink the same cup. You're not getting away with anything. So Zion has already experienced Yahweh's wrath, but the nations, including Edom, have yet to experience it. That's what the day of the Lord is about. Remember, again, if you had prior, in your Bible study or maybe preaching about the day of the Lord, the day of the Lord is this time in the future when all that is wrong gets set right. All of God's enemies are judged, and those who are faithful to God get rewarded for their faithfulness, either in the current life or the life to come. I mean, it's the day when everything just gets set right. So, this is part of what Obadiah is looking at. Zion has already experienced Yahweh's wrath, but the nations have not. Now think about that. Think about that line. I'm going to read it again. Okay. Zion has already experienced Yahweh's wrath, but the nations have yet to experience it. Again, in the future, they're going to be repaid. All of the nations are going to get repaid. There's going to be wrath come against all the nations because the wrath against Israel, the wrath against Zion, has already occurred. That was the exile. That's what happened to the northern kingdom at the hand of the Assyrians and the southern kingdom at the hand of the Babylonians. Obadiah announces that the nations will drink of the same cup as Jerusalem. Now, here's why I'm belaboring this. Here's my question, especially for those of you who are into eschatology. Okay, here we've drifted into it again. What does this say? What does this whole message about, hey, Jerusalem, Israel has already drunk from the cup of God's wrath, and the nations are going to drink from it. What does this say? What does this do to a theology that interprets the tribulation period as a judgment against Jews, as a judgment against Israel? This is very common in pop eschatology. This seven-year tribulation idea, oh, well, the church is taken away to escape the wrath of God. And this is God's judgment being poured out on Israel. Well, now, wait a minute. Really? Okay, I thought Israel's sins had been paid for. Like Isaiah said, in a double portion. Here we have a prophetic oracle saying, hey, Zion has drunk from this cup. The next ones who are going to drink it are the nations. Day of the Lord kind of stuff. We talked about the tribulation in an earlier episode of the podcast, that the tribulation language in the New Testament, it's not referring to the punishment of Jews. it's referring to the persecution of people who embrace the Messiah. Jesus says, when I show up, you know, I'm going to bring persecution. I'm going to bring a sword. I mean, this is just what's going to happen. But yet, pop eschatology so often takes this language, again, to justify certain eschatological schemes or systems. And they say, oh, well, no, this is against the Jews. This is against Israel. Well, maybe this is why nobody ever teaches from Obadiah or frankly, lots of the Old Testament. What happens is the Old Testament gets filtered through a theological system. It gets filtered through an already existing system of end times thinking. And what I'm suggesting here is that stuff really needs to be rethought. You know, these Old Testament statements, instead of filtering them through Professor So-and-so's or best-selling author So-and-so's latest book or some recent eschatological system that's been around a couple hundred years or whoever, who cares how long it's been around? You know, it could be around for a millennium. Instead of filtering the Old Testament through these systems to understand end times, why don't we just let the Old Testament be read in its own context? Why don't we try that? Well, again, if you do that, it's going to mess up the systems. And if you're a listener to this podcast, you know that I really don't care. I'm sort of here to mess up the systems. That's if I want. I guess if I have a ministry, it's messing up the systems. You know, I'm trying to get people to just read the text on its own terms. And this is one of those fundamental points. There's these fundamental little pieces of popular eschatology that really needs examination and scrutiny, because you're going to get language in here, the Oracles Against the Nations, that just don't really work well with it. So again, if you have, think about the book of Acts. I mean, we went through the whole book of Acts on this podcast, okay? The whole book of Acts shows salvation and forgiveness being extended to Israel, to Jews. The Jew first and also to the Greek. Okay, everywhere Paul, you know, you go through the first 9 chapters of Acts and all these places that apostles go to are constituent parts of the territories that lie within the boundaries of the promised land, including those portions that went apostate. And the messaging is, look, we are bringing the message of the Messiah to the Jew, to all of the people, within, you know, Israel, who need to hear the news about the Messiah, because it's their Messiah. And once that task is done, then the narrative turns to the Gentiles. Okay, Peter's vision, Paul's calling, you know, as an apostle to the Gentiles. But the point is, nobody's walking around saying, well, you know, who gives a rip about what happens if the Jews believe or not? Because they're going to get punished later anyway. They got the 7-year tribulation bearing down on them. That's God's wrath against the Jews again. That is not the picture that you get in the book of Acts. Forgiveness and salvation are extended to them just as equally as it is to the Gentile. And next week, again, we're going to get into specifically, you know, I'll telegraph it, Amos 9, 10 through 12. And how it's quoted in Acts 15, because the Amos passage references Edom directly, okay, about the house of David being restored. Okay, but what Acts 15 does with it, and you know, I've mentioned this before in our series on the Book of Acts, we got into this a little bit more. Edom, I'm not. You're going to have to go back and look at it. Edom, in the Old Testament reference, is changed to a different word when James cites it in Acts 15. And it's a really, really telling word, especially with what we've been talking about in these last few minutes. But again, even a book like Obadiah, if you think about Edom, Edom is this representative of Babylon, the other nations. And again, you compare, and we'll do some of this next week, very specifically comparing what is in Obadiah with some Old Testament passages and again, some New Testament touch points. It does take you into this whole thing about, okay, when did the exile end? What is the tribulation? What's going on here? What about the exile ending and that happening in conjunction with Edom being restored, you know, brought back into the fold with all the other nations? How do we parse that? How do we interpret that? Again, it's taking you into the same questions. Back to Obadiah, verse 17. Now, think about this one. We're going to talk about this one next week too. Again, spend more time on it. Just look at what it says, verse 17. But in Mount Zion, there shall be those who escape. and it shall be holy, and the house of Jacob shall possess their own possessions. Verse 18, the house of Jacob shall be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame, and the house of Esau stubble. They shall burn them and consume them, and there shall be no survivor for the house of Esau, for the Lord has spoken. Escaping Mount Zion. Again, what is this house of Joseph thing? I mean, I could see the house of Jacob, because that's Israel. That's like, you know, David's in that line, you know, all that kind of stuff. Well, hey, Joseph's a tribe too. Well, why bring Joseph up? Again, there are some connections here to how Jews were thinking about end times eschatologically that spring, you know, from this passage, Jacob, Joseph. And of course, Esau is the one who's going to be overturned. Verse 19, those of the Negev shall possess Mount Esau, and those of the Shephelah shall possess the land of the Philistines. And they shall possess the land of Ephraim, the land of Samaria, and the Benjamin shall possess Gilead. The exiles of this host of the people of Israel shall possess the land of the Canaanites, as far as Zarephath, and the exiles of Jerusalem who are in Sepharvarad shall possess the cities of the Negev. And it's this repossession language. Last verse of Obadiah, just catch this, saviors, plural, shall go up to Mount Zion to rule Mount Esau, and the kingdom shall be the Lord's. Again, we're going to save a lot of that for the second installment, but I think you can see just by reading it that, believe it or not, Obadiah has things to contribute that need to mold our thinking about how we understand what it means to return from exile, okay, what it means for all Israel, okay, Israel, really, the true Israel, to be saved, what it means for the nations to be repossessed by Yahweh in the kingdom. Okay, the tiny little book of Obadiah has things in it that need to inform our thinking about these topics, and they are inherently eschatological. So next time, we're going to return to some of these sections and factor in specific connections to, again, New Testament thinking, New Testament language, and in particular, the Amos 9 passage, where it talks about, it connects, again, the rebuilding of David's house, and again, taking possession of the remnant of Edom. That sort of language and how that's used in the New Testament and why it's important.
All right, Mike, that's pretty interesting there. Who would have thought?
Who would have thought?
Who would have thought? All right, Mike, well, I want to switch gears here, and you've got an announcement where you're going to be on Coast to Coast, at least here in July 3rd.
Yeah, the evening of July 3rd, I'm going to be on for 2 hours. Now, that what the producers have told me is I'm going to be on from 10 p.m. to midnight Pacific time, so you can do the math there. And as far as I know, that the topic is going to be Unseen Realm, because that's what we've talked about in email. Those of you who have heard me on Coast to Coast before, heard me talk about Coast to Coast, know that there's a bit of an unpredictability element to what the host might want to talk about. But hopefully, you know, it'll be about Unseen Realm content, Divine Counsel stuff. So if you can tune in, please do.
Okay, well, that sounds good, Mike. We anticipate Obadiah Part 2 next week, and just want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.